We have a fine number this morning. We're very happy to have everyone with us. There are numerous ones who are here for the very first time, and we are especially happy that you are here. If you have not already done so, we do encourage you to fill out a visitor's card and let us have a record of your visit. As you can tell, we are trying to do a little bit of remodeling here. We're trying to expand our facility. I don't see any reason why we need to be doing that, but for some reason we're doing that. And appreciate Mickey Oliver and those young men who came yesterday to help do a little bit of demolition back there. And we realize that for the next little while we're going to be inconvenienced here. And even as we finish this particular remodeling effort, it's just temporary. For the benefit of those who maybe are not aware of this, we have purchased some property just right down the street, and so Lord willing, in about 3 years, we're going to be able to begin developing that property and move into a new facility. But in the meantime, we're trying to make this facility accommodate our needs as best as we can. So we're glad that you are with us, and especially those who are visiting with us this morning. In our auditorium class, we began this morning to look at the book of Hebrews. And the book of Hebrews is a marvelous epistle, and it begins in a marvelous way. And the things that are said in the introduction to this book, the very first four verses of the book of Hebrews, are things that are so beneficial, not just for someone who's going to be in the Hebrews class, but for all of us. And so I thought it would be good for us to look at these opening verses of the Epistle to the Hebrews, to look at them together and talk about what these verses have to say to us. I want to begin this morning by just reading these first verses of the Epistle to the Hebrews. Before I do that, let me just ask, I'm hearing a hum. Is the microphone on a little bit too loud, or is that just me up here? A little bit too loud? Okay, we'll have that taken care of. Let me go ahead and read these first few verses. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days spoke to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world, who being the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature and upholding all things by the word of his power, having made purification of sins, sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much better than the angels. And with those words, the Hebrew writer then makes a wonderful segue into the first section of his book, where he will show from the Old Testament scriptures that the Son of God who was to come indeed would be and was greater than even the angels. This is a marvelous introduction to the book, and the way that this opening set of verses is constructed by the Hebrew writer, by the inspiration of God, is truly remarkable. It's a very complex sentence. It's a long, complex sentence in the original. One sentence in the original. Sometimes our versions will divide it up into several sentences, as you see here, but actually it's one long sentence, and it is a masterpiece. Because of so much that is contained in this sentence and so much that it has to say. Do you remember when you were in ninth grade English class and you were called upon to diagram sentences? At least when I had English grammar in those early years, it was in my ninth grade English class where we had to learn how to diagram complex sentences. A scintillating task, if ever there was one. And my English teacher at the time, I'll never forget her. She was an elderly woman. Her name was Mrs. Jackson, and she talked like this.
and she wanted to teach us to diagram English sentences. And she did. And she taught us about the simple sentence. Do you recall that? The subject and the main verb. That's the simple sentence. That's the main sentence. That's the basic sentence. And then attached to that, you would typically have in a complex sentence some participial clauses or some relative pronouns that introduce other dependent clauses and all these kinds of things that can make a sentence extremely lengthy. And yet, when you diagram it, you're looking at all of those pieces of that sentence and how they all fit and connect to the simple sentence, the main part of the sentence. Well, I don't want to give you an English lesson here when it comes to Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. But I do want to talk with you this morning as we begin about the simple part of the sentence here. It's a lengthy, complex sentence, but the subject and the main verb of the sentence are these two words. God spoke. The main verb, the finite verb of this lengthy sentence upon which everything else hangs, is the verb spoke. And the subject of that verb in the sentence is God. And what the Hebrew writer is doing here is making a point about the fact that God spoke. God spoke in times past in the prophets, in many portions and in many ways. He's talking about the Old Testament prophets and those whom we read about in the Old Testament scriptures. God spoke to man in them. But he says in these last days, God spoke to us in his Son. And once you begin to realize the additional things that the Hebrew writer gives to that one simple sentence, God spoke, you begin to see that the most important additional element that he adds to this simple sentence is that prepositional phrase, in his Son. Because he's talking about the fact that the God who spoke long ago has now spoken to us at this point in human history in the greatest messenger of all, the greatest spokesman for God of all, his Son, Jesus Christ. And I want to tell you what, folks, we need to be impressed with the fact that the Creator of all things has communicated himself to us. The mere fact that God has spoken to us as human beings indicates God wants to have a relationship with us as human beings. You speak to those people you want to relate to. You want to be involved with. If there's somebody that you're interested in, whether it's as a friend or as a potential girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, you speak to them. Speech is how we initiate relationships. That's how we sustain relationships. God has spoken to us as human beings, and the fact that he has done that is a testimony to the fact that he, for some reason, cares enough about us to have a relationship with us. And that's just astounding when you stop and think about who God is. The Creator of all things cares that much about us. And he says that God has spoken in two ways. At least in this sentence, he divides up the way that God has spoken to us historically into two different segments. First of all, how God spoke in times past through the prophets, but he contrasts that with now God having spoken to us in his Son. And that's pretty impressive, that God has spoken to us in these two ways. He spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways. It makes me think of our Old Testament history and think about Abraham. Remember how God spoke to that particular man and identified himself as God Almighty and brought that man out of Ur of the Chaldees and that pagan background that Abraham and his family knew. And God revealed a little bit to this individual Abraham, who would be the father of then this nation of people that God would create. The Hebrew writer says God spoke long ago to the fathers in many portions and in many ways, and that was one particular way that God gave a portion of revelation in times past to Abraham. You go on further throughout Old Testament history and think about God speaking to the Israelites through Moses. Probably the only preacher that can preach and break things at the same time. All right, hopefully I didn't break it. If I did, Bill will fix it, right, Bill? Okay. God spoke through Moses. And God spoke through Moses in a greater portion and in a different way than he had ever spoken to Abraham. He spoke to Moses face to face, and Moses ascended to Mount Sinai, and God in some manifestation, some angelic form, spoke with Moses there face to face, and he gave Moses the laws of the Mosaic system that Moses then might convey those to the people. Moses was a great, great prophet and lawgiver. I think about how God spoke in a different way to David. You recall David, the sweet singer of Israel, where God revealed to him all of those psalms, so many of them recorded in our Old Testament Psalter. And God communicating to this man in a special way who would be that first of a long succession of kings, that house of David that God granted the rulership of all Israel forever. And indeed, God spoke in a portion and in a particular way to David. God spoke also in a different way to David's son Solomon. In fact, here it wasn't so much in Psalms, but to Solomon, God was speaking in the form of wisdom. And of course, Solomon is associated with so many of these Proverbs and that wisdom literature. And so God spoke to Israel by means of Solomon and all the wisdom instruction that he gave. You go on further in Old Testament history and you think about these prophets that God sent to the nation, especially those prophets during that divided monarchy period. You recall Elijah? Here's a man who was sent to that northern kingdom of Israel, and God, as he spoke to Elijah in a particular portion of material, gave him a little bit of revelation. In a very unique way, had Elijah dress in that animal skin and just dress as someone as if he had been devastated by an army who had come through and stolen every possession. And that's how Elijah dressed as he gave his prophecies. As he spoke to the nation, that portion of information that Yahweh had revealed to him. And it was a message that indeed judgment was going to come upon all of God's nation, all of God's people. And they all would lose everything and would be paupers and destitute. And they all would eventually look like Elijah in the way that he dressed. When you think about the prophets of Judah and prophets like Isaiah, that great prophet there in Jerusalem, you recall how God gave him that vision when he called him to be a prophet, Isaiah chapter 6. And Isaiah sees this vision of God as if he were on his throne, some kind of manifestation of God, just to give Isaiah a picture of the greatness of Yahweh. And all the seraphim that are around and the holiness of the entire scene. And then it was through Isaiah that God, in a very unique way, revealed the message about future judgment through the sons that Isaiah would have and the names that were given to those children. Names that talked about how God was going to disperse and spread out his people, and that indeed the armies would come swiftly in and come in upon their prey and take all of the spoils of war. And those names given to those children were a testimonial to the prophecies of Isaiah. God was speaking in a particular way, in a particular portion to Israel by means of Isaiah the prophet. Think about Daniel when they finally were taken into exile. God used Daniel in a rather unique way. He had not spoken to the other prophets in quite the same way that he's spoken to Daniel. Daniel is there in the Babylonian court of in a foreign nation, raised as a court official there in this foreign nation. And God, in that foreign location, reveals the message to Daniel, several visions that talk about the future of the nations of the world, including the kingdom that God would one day set up. What a marvelous way in which God revealed himself to the Israelites through Daniel and his visionary prophecies. And then talking about visions, you can't help but think about the visions that Zechariah received when the nation had come back from Babylonian exile, at least a small portion of the people had come back from Babylonian exile, and God spoke to the people through Zechariah the prophet, and the great vision of the temple of God, the temple that was being rebuilt there in Jerusalem, rebuilt by Zerubbabel, the seed of David, and yet all of that, the vision of Zechariah revealed, was something that was a foretaste of what God would ultimately do when he established his great kingdom and the throne of David would be restored. The Hebrew writer says, God spoke. And he spoke to our fathers long ago in many portions and in many different ways. But the Hebrew writer says, in these last days, God has now spoken to us in his Son. And that's a marvelous thing to contemplate. Because all of those prophets that we alluded to, and so many others that we could have talked about, those prophets in Old Testament history, none of them were the Son of God. Oh, you think about David as the king? And God had said to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 14, David, just like all the kings of this world, they speak of themselves as being the son of their chief deity in their pantheon of gods. Well, David, I'm going to regard you and your royal seed, your descendants, as my sons. Yeah, David and Solomon and the successors on David's throne, they were sons of God in that sense, but the Hebrew writer is talking about this final Son of God, who's a unique Son of God, an only begotten Son of God, different from anyone else. And this is the one whom God has spoken to us through or in now, this Son of His. But you know why the Hebrew writer had to emphasize that point so much? The same reason why I think we need to emphasize to ourselves and have it emphasized to us the greatness of the fact that God has spoken to us in his Son. It's because sometimes people don't really appreciate how great the Son of God really is. The Hebrew writer was writing to Jewish Christians who were being tempted to just go back to the Judaism they'd always known. That Judaism that was before the advent of Jesus. That Mosaic Judaism that was talked about in the Jewish scriptures. And that's what they were being drawn back to fully and completely. Why were they being drawn back to all that? The Hebrew writer wants them to understand it's because you don't appreciate fully who the Son of God who's speaking to you now, who he really is. And so you think about who the Son is that the Hebrew writer is talking about. Is this the Son of God? What was it about this individual walking in Galilee that said, I'm great, I'm the Son of the Creator, I'm the Messiah, I'm the great King? Anything about him that had anything royal or regal? No, as Isaiah one time said, there was no stately form or majesty that we should be attracted to him. Nothing about Jesus of Nazareth in Galilee, or when he would make his treks through Samaria or Judea, that in any way would say to anybody looking at him, here's someone who is great, much less, he's the great Son of God. Certainly nothing that would seem to imply divine sonship about this Jesus of Nazareth when he's arrested there in Jerusalem, when he's taken and scourged and the flesh ripped from his body and treated as a criminal and charged as a criminal. Nothing special or regal or royal or divine about that. Can you imagine what it would have been to have been there at the cross as people were looking at this one whose body was nailed to that wood and stretched out for all to see? Can you see anything special about him? Anything regal about him? If you got close enough, you probably could smell the sweat on his body, the stench, the blood. His sweat and blood-soaked garments that then they stripped from him and gambled for. Anything special about this criminal? This blasphemer? He's supposed to be the Son of God. The Hebrew writer is trying to help these people see, you don't understand who the Son really is. Yes, that individual in Galilee is the Son of God. Yes, that individual who was arrested and scourged is the Son of God. Yes, that man who was crucified as a reprobate criminal, yes, he really is the Son of God. And the Hebrew writer is saying, if you don't understand that he is the Son of God and that he merits every bit of loyalty and dedication, you don't understand who the Son really is. And so here's what he does as he begins this great epistle. He says, I want to describe who the Son is. And he gives seven things that are true about the Son, Jesus of Nazareth. He says, this Son is the one who is the heir of all things. Don't just look at him as some criminal, as some reprobate. You need to understand that's the individual that God appointed to be the heir of all things. And the reason why he's heir of all things is because the Son of God, the Son of anyone, is naturally the heir of everything that belongs to his Father. And that individual, Jesus, who was crucified, that individual is the one whom God declared is my Son. I've appointed him heir of all things. And more than that, the Hebrew writer says, he is the one through whom God made the entire world. That's right. Oh, you would never have guessed that looking at him in Galilee and even hearing him teach. And you certainly wouldn't have guessed that he was the one through whom God made all things if you gazed at him upon that cross. But the Hebrew writer takes us back to Genesis 1, where God spoke all things into existence, the text says. The Hebrew writer wants us to understand there's a little bit of information that was not revealed to Moses when he wrote Genesis, when God was revealing in those portions and those ways back in times past, when God spoke all things into existence, he spoke through the Son. And the Son is the one who was saying, let there be light. And the Son is the one who was saying, let this occur and that be created and this and that. He made all things through the Son. That's who he is. He's the radiance of the glory of God. The word that's translated radiance, effulgence, maybe in some of your versions. It's a word in the original that talks about what we mean when we talk about a light or a lamp, and then the light that radiates from it. What manifests the light is the radiance of that light. That's what we see. That's what's visible to us. And the Hebrew writer in trying to come up with some kind of analogy to help us appreciate exactly who this son is, he says, that's how you need to think of him. He is the radiance. He is the effulgence of the glory of God himself. He says, using a similar expression, he is the exact representation of God's nature. And here the word that is used is a word that might have been used in that first century world to talk about, say, if you had a seal or some kind of a signet or an impress and it had an image on it, maybe like the image of a ruler when you would have their image impressed upon a coin. And when that would be pressed into that, and so the image that is the exact representation of the seal itself. And so you see the image, and that's what lets you understand the seal that you might not ever have witnessed. And he says, that's who the Son is. God didn't come into the world personally, but yet, in another way of speaking, yes, he did, because God came into the world in the person of his Son, and his Son is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature. That's who he is. And he is the one who upholds all things by the word of his power. Folks, this world that God created, this world that the Hebrew writer says God created through the Son acting on behalf of the Father, this world is sustained and this world continues, and everything that goes on in this world, everything that we rely upon to have breath and life and the opportunity to live and function in this world, it is all because the Son of God upholds all things by his word. And were he to say, at the impetus of the Father, let all of these things be destroyed, that's what would happen. That's what he would declare, and it would occur. The Hebrew writer is saying, that's who the Son of God is. He is the one whom we owe everything to, because everything that we rely upon right now for existence itself is only ours because he himself continues to uphold it by his authoritative word. That's power. That's authority. That's who the Son is. And then he goes on to say, but he's the one who made purification of sins. And when you appreciate the five things he said prior to this and begin to appreciate who this Son is, the fact that that is the individual, he's the individual who made purification of sins in the way that he did it, it just becomes astounding. Because he didn't make purification of sins like some Levitical priest would by going up to an altar and putting an animal on there and sacrificing an animal. He didn't make purification of sins by doing what an Aaronic priest would do by pouring the wine upon the altar of the sacrifice. The way that he made purification of sins, the only way that the Son of God could make purification of sins, the only way, and he did it this way, was to offer up himself upon the cross. That was his altar. And he allowed himself to be scourged and to be nailed and to be affixed to that cross. And he poured out the wine of his blood as it dripped from his body on the cross. That's how he made purification of sin. And that's how it had to happen, or else purification could not have occurred. That's who the Son of God is. And then the Hebrew writer completes his sevenfold description by saying he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. There are two finite verbs in this one long sentence. The first one, God spoke. The second one is the verb that we render in English, sat down. And those are the two main thoughts. God spoke in his Son, and the Son sat down on the heavenly throne at the right hand of the majesty on high. And when you appreciate who the Son is, where else could he have rightfully sat? That was where he needed to go to reign. Not some earthly throne in Jerusalem, no, but the real heavenly throne of God itself, at God's right hand, doing all things at the behest of his Father, the one in whom his Father has always functioned. That's who the Son of God is. That's who he continues to be. And he sat down at the right hand of God. And the Hebrew writer says, he therefore became in a position far greater than any of the angels. Of course. Because no angel ever was this kind of being. No angel ever was the Son of God. But he was. That's who Jesus of Nazareth is. What's the point of all this? Folks, there are so many people in our world today who reject Jesus. Why do they reject him? How can they reject him? Do you know how? There are people who are Christians who've been baptized into Jesus Christ. And they've affirmed that they understand who Jesus is. And then after some period of time, they then fall away and just drift back to the world. That's what the Hebrew writer's audience, that's what they were in danger of doing. And that's what people in our day do. They just kind of drift back to the world. How can they do that? Why do they do that? I'll tell you why. They don't understand who Jesus really is. Oh, they understand he's the Son of God. But they don't know what that means. They don't get it. Some of us struggle with things in our lives, and there are some of you who's struggling with things in your life, whether it's health or whether it's financial difficulties or other kinds of problems and things in our life that just cause us to become distressed and depressed and down, and we become lackadaisical as Christians. And we allow the things of this world to just overwhelm us so that we just stop being what we should be. There are some Christians who never really start acting as they should be. They're always this weak, lackadaisical Christian, always on the periphery, never really involved in the church, just kind of visiting the church services every now and then might be the best way to put it. How can people who claim to be Christians, who claim to be followers of the Son of God, how can they do that? How can they be so lackadaisical? And so on the periphery of service to God, how can that happen? I'll tell you how it happens. You don't really understand who he is. You don't get it. And that's what these Jewish Christians 2,000 years ago, that's what their problem was. They didn't really understand who the Son of God really was. And the Hebrew writer says, I want you to understand who the Son is. He's the heir of all things. He's the maker of this world. He's the radiance of God's glory itself. He's the exact representation of his divine nature. He is the upholder of all things. He's the purifier of our sins by giving himself to purify our sins. And he is the one who has sat down at the right hand of the majesty of God on high in heaven itself right now, looking down upon us in all of his regal glory. That's who Jesus is. Do you understand that? Do you really know who Jesus is? Do you? I want to encourage all of us this week to live this week as people who really understand who the Son of God is. Live it. And if you're weak, and if you're going through a time of difficulty, and you're tempted to not be what you should be, go back and read these first four verses of the book of Hebrews. Be reminded of who the Son is. He's the one whom you dedicated yourself to when you were immersed into him and arose to walk in newness of life in service to the Son. He's the one. Do you really understand and really know who your Master is? I hope we can think about that. Is there someone this morning who needs to make their life right with the Son? He's looking down upon you now. And he's always willing to accept even those who have defected for some time from him. He's always willing to accept them back into loyalty to him. This is the King we're talking about. This is your King, the Son of God. Won't you come make your life right with him now? While together we stand and sing.